From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. Hi, everybody. I'm John Raby, in for John Horn. Today, who would get what in the $44 million Harvey Weinstein settlement proposal? Plus, an Icelandic artist celebrates the experimental Fluxus art movement by looping the final aria of The Marriage of Figaro for 12 straight hours.
Really, what I'm trying to achieve is to like make this part of an opera, which is a narrative structure, like stop being narrative and make it like a sculpture or a painting.
Plus, I'll talk with art reporter Jory Finkel, who's trying to break down gallery walls by having artists tell us about the piece of art that inspired them the most. Stay tuned for The Frame. There's a $44 million tentative settlement in the civil portion of the Harvey Weinstein sexual misconduct case. The Wall Street Journal broke the story. I called reporter Corinne Ramey in the Journal's newsroom and asked her, how'd they wind up with $44
million? That $44 million comes from months and months of pretty contentious negotiations over what women should be paid, how they should be paid, and who should pay it.
Right, and a dozen mediation sessions that I guess got pretty ugly.
Yeah, they did get ugly because there were a lot of competing interests at play here. There were women who said they were victims and should be compensated, and a lot of these are women who filed lawsuits. There were also insurance companies, the New York Attorney General's office, which filed its own civil rights lawsuit about employment conditions against both Harvey Weinstein and his company.
And we should be very clear here, this is not just a settlement that involves Harvey Weinstein.
Absolutely. There's quite a few women who sued Harvey Weinstein, but some of these same women, including in a proposed class action suit, sued board members, former officers and directors, executives, and all kinds of people who surrounded Harvey Weinstein, saying that they knew about his alleged behavior and enabled it. And so this proposed settlement also would end any legal proceedings for all those other defendants.
Adam Harris, who was Bob Weinstein's lawyer, announced the settlement saying, we now have an economic agreement in principle that is supported by the plaintiffs. Is, though, this settlement what the plaintiffs had hoped for?
It's not even close. I think the plaintiffs, and to say plaintiffs, I mean particularly the class of women who say they were abused by Mr. Weinstein, had hoped for way, way more money. And so in a way, this is a little bit of a disappointment.
The breakdown goes, it's $44 million proposed,
mm-hmm.
$30 million goes to the plaintiffs, $14 million goes to pay legal fees. How is that $30 million going to be broken up, do we know?
So I do want to say this is still tentative. It's mm-hmm. a sort of proposed agreement, and some of these details are still being worked out. But we know that $30 would include money that would go to women, to former Weinstein Company employees, and then also studio creditors. Mr. Weinstein's former studio is going through bankruptcy right now, and so this process is also to resolve some claims in bankruptcy.
And then I would assume for the plaintiffs who allege sexual harassment that it would be a sliding scale based on the severity of the harassment?
Again, these details are still being ironed out, but the way these things typically work is that there would be some sort of special master or person sort of in charge of awarding appropriate amounts of money to different people who apply to get money from the victim's fund and in exchange agree to either drop their lawsuit or not file one.
Where's the $44 million coming from?
Insurance companies are paying all of it.
You can buy insurance to cover illegal acts?
Well, it's complicated. These are sort of these broad employment policies, and what they're actually covering is defense costs. And so it's defense costs not just for Harvey, but also for the directors and officers. Those are the former executives, former board members at Weinstein Studio, and women have sued them, alleging that they sort of facilitated Harvey's behavior.
Does Weinstein admit any guilt in this $44 million proposed settlement?
He does not. It's important to mention, though, too, that there's a criminal case against Weinstein in Manhattan, and this does not impact the criminal case in any way.
You know, and if you read the comment section in any of the newspaper stories about this, a lot of people are saying Harvey Weinstein just bought himself out of jail. But no, this is the civil part of the suits against him, not the criminal parts.
Yes, this is only civil suits. There's a lot of them, but they are all civil. And criminal charges, they're still there. He's expected to go to trial in September.
When they pick a jury for this trial, are they ever going to be able to find a juror who doesn't know that there was a $44 million settlement?
They're probably going to, sort of to answer that question more broadly, they're going to have trouble finding a juror who's not aware of Harvey Weinstein. But that's okay. What they're, at the end of the day, what they'll need to look for is people who sort of haven't made up their mind about Harvey, or people who say that they can be fair and only listen to the evidence at trial and not include in their thought process all these other things I've read in the news.
What's the next step for the settlement?
Well, it's not final. There are further discussions coming up between all the parties, so they need to sort of hammer out these last minute details, see if they can all agree on them, and my understanding is that the settlement will also have to be approved by a judge.
Corinne Ramey, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Corinne, thanks very much.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up on The Frame, an artist who's looping the last aria of The Marriage of Figaro for 12 hours. John Horn asks why. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby. What happens when you take a few moments from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro and play it over and over and over? Audiences are going to find out Saturday at downtown LA's Red Cat Theater when Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson presents Bliss, a 12-hour loop of the final moments of the opera. It's part of the Fluxus Festival, hosted by the LA Phil and the Getty Research Institute in honor of the experimental Fluxus art movement of the 1960s. John Horn caught a rehearsal yesterday, well, part of a rehearsal, at Red Cat, and asked Kjartansson how directing Bliss compares to directing the whole opera.
It's a very, very different approach. I mean, when you're doing The Marriage of Figaro, then you're just doing the whole production. You're just rehearsing the music and, like, directorially laying out the plot, etc. But here we're just working with this musical part. And really what I'm trying to achieve is to, like, to kind of make this part of an opera, which is a narrative structure, like, stop being narrative and make it like a sculpture or a painting. That you just, like, walk in as an audience member and see, and then you just walk out again and maybe check it out again. But you know it's always the same, like a painting on the wall. But for 12 hours, yeah.
So if the audience experiences it in a different way, do the performers as well? Does it become something different for them through repetition about what it is they're doing? Is it more like muscle memory? Has it become less about character? How has the performer's mind changed? Because the audience's mind has definitely changed.
Yeah, I mean, as a performer, like, what I really like about doing it is you really just sink into the music. And the lyrics and the situation. It stops being about, like, you know, what is happening now in the opera. You're just like, wow, you're just there. But then again, like, you're there for 12 hours and you're singing this beautiful music and it almost starts to become white noise. You just don't realize that you're singing anymore and you just don't hear anymore. But you're doing it anyway and just thinking about sandwiches or something.
And why this particular part of the opera? Because this is a aria about forgiveness. It's an aria where a man has done some very bad things or tried to do some very bad things and hasn't completely succeeded, but he's had bad intentions. And he is forgiven because the person who is forgiving him is, I think she says it, better than he is. Why is that idea of what happens in this story so important to recognize and to repeat about what it's saying about forgiveness and reconciliation?
I'm so in awe of this part of the opera for so many, like, multi-layered reasons. It's also just, like, it's also written by Lorenzo del Ponte and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and, like, you know, it's around the time when, like, modernity is being created. It's around the time when America is becoming America and the French Revolution and whatnot. And then there comes this opera about just pleasure and lust. And then there's this moment of forgiveness and then like reconciliation. But also, it's ironic. Like, they're saying they forgive each other, but you know that the characters are not really forgiving each other. And nobody is happy forever after. That's what I love about this part of, like, it's kind of one of my favorite parts of, like, the whole idea of, like, Western art, because it's so multi-layered and complicated that it's, like, you can feel that it was really written tongue-in-cheek, but it's so beautiful that you cry. I always imagine Mozart just, like, really tongue-in-cheek, but, like, it's so beautiful.
You have been interested in repetition a lot in your art. Does the story change the more times you see it? Do you start seeing the story in a different way as an audience member the more times you see it?
Yeah, maybe, if you have imagination. I think so. But like, I myself, I don't really have imagination. I just see the same thing over and over again and kind of sort of becomes beautifully mundane for me. But some people I know who have imagination start seeing different things. And also, I think that is important in this piece and all art pieces that I make, that it's really just belongs to the viewer, to what the viewer feels.
And how does repetition change what the viewer experiences? As opposed to just looking at something once and leaving the room, what does the repeat viewing do in terms of how we interpret or see something or hear something?
Repetition is like, it's such a weirdly important thing in our culture and like in all cultures. We always use repetition to make things holy. Like, every religion has repetition at its core. And of course, we feel the security of repetition. And I'm just really interested in seeing dramatic things like stuck in this repetition. Then they stop becoming narrative and dramatic and they just become sculptural. And it's almost just like you can look at them from all sides.
We're talking with Ragnar Kjartansson about his staging of Bliss. You have performed in this piece as well. What is the mindset that gets you through a performance? And at what point are you kind of losing focus? How do you stay focused? How do you make sure that through the 12 hours of performance that you are able to do your work repeatedly without falling apart?
I never have any like special method for it. Because the funny thing is, like, performance art is always like this heroic thing. We're going to do this for 12 hours. But like, everybody has a job and they just do the repetitive thing for hours and hours. And so this is not so far away from a regular job, but it's like you just go. I just go to it like I was like working at McDonald's. It's just like I just gotta do it now. I'm just on the job. So that's kind of the mindset I have. But it's a job I really love, and I just enjoy every moment of it. Although sometimes I'm bored, but the boredom is it's almost like a relief in our modern times to like be bored. It's just just the idea of like, we're going to perform this and I'm just going to be doing nothing but this for 12 hours. It's really like, it's like the idea of some kind of a vacation, like no decisions about anything for 12 hours.
We're on radio, so we can't really picture what it is that audiences will see. But how would you describe the setting and the costumes for this production?
Total cliche. Like,
very Rococo.
Very Rococo, very much off the period, just classical staging. And I just really like classical staging. I just love the idea of like painted sets and stuff like that.
And do the performers get to eat and drink? Do they leave stage? Are they snacking on stage? How do you make sure that they have enough energy to keep going? And I guess including that are the people who are playing the music.
We just bring food and snacks to the stage.
Think about like a signaling, like if you really need a drink. Then I think you should just like look at me. Just look at me and do this and get some water.
And we have two valets who come and bring stuff to the stage. And then also if somebody like has to leave the stage, they just leave just for a short break.
And, like, Marilena takes your place. Like, and then in the next part, then you just start singing wherever you are. And I think that is sort of nice.
Yeah.
To just like, to break it up very gently, so it's not like...
But we continue always.
And how would you place Bliss inside the bigger idea of the Fluxus movement?
I mean, it definitely, like, I am an artist that just totally derives from the Fluxus movement. Like, I owe the idea of my art and my attitude towards art really towards the Fluxus movement. No, I think it's important that Fluxus is mainly, you know, it's not about the rules. It's about freedom and breaking rules and kind of the joy of art. Like, I got to know and understand art through Fluxus. I always thought art is an idea. And that's, I think, what I got. I got that definitely from Fluxus.
When was the last time you staged Bliss?
That was in 2011 at Performa in New York.
So that's 8 years ago.
It's 8 years ago.
How has the performance and the experience changed in your mind as you've grown older and as the world has changed? Does it feel different to you?
Yeah, it feels very different. We're in a very different era now than we were in 2011, you know. Everything now is somewhat politically meaningful. It wasn't in 2011, you know. And just like the whole misogyny, yeah. Just the misogyny of like the whole idea of the marriage of Figaro and the count. Like he has the right to sleep with his servants and that, all that kind of stuff. It's just so brutal. But then it's in this like really nice Rococo thing, which I find really interesting. It's all beautiful, but it also looks very violent.
And what does the title mean to you? Why did you call it Bliss?
Because this part is just bliss. This part of the marriage of Figaro. Like, I have been to many staging of the marriage of Figaro just to wait for that part. Because when it comes, it's just... It's just like, it is bliss. It's just... And the idea with this piece is just to stay in that, because it's like the greatest musical bliss I know is just to listen to that part of Marriage of Figaro.
Ragnar, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Ragnar Kjartansson with John Horn. Tickets to Bliss are sold out. Coming up, 50 artists get together to help you see art differently when The Frame continues. Jory Finkel, who covers art for the New York Times and the Art Newspaper, thinks a lot of museums and galleries do a lousy job helping people understand and enjoy the art on their walls. Who could do a better job? Maybe artists. Jory's new book, It Speaks to Me, is interviews with 50 artists about the single piece of art that inspired them the most. Jory, welcome to The Frame.
Thank you for your interest.
Why should we care about what artists think about work by other artists?
Artists are really experts in seeing. They look at things closely, look at things that we might not even notice. If you go on TripAdvisor, you can find thousands of reviews of the Getty Museum. Most talk about the gardens.
Yeah.
Bill Viola in this book points you to the one painting of the Virgin Mary that you really need to see. And then he explains why this is going to change your world.
Gillian Waring picked Rembrandt's self-portrait at the age of 63. Why did it speak to her?
Her entire history as an artist has been concerned with self-portraiture. Most famously, she makes portraits of herself disguised as family members or friends. And so for her to choose a Rembrandt self-portrait is really consistent with what she does and what she thinks about. And then she talks about the kind of raw beauty of this self-portrait and how unfussy it is.
One of the most intriguing entries in your book is from photographer Stephen Shore, who picked a two-dimensional wood carving from the 1400s at the Met in New York. And it's like a life-size carving that looks like you're looking into a library, but you're not. The whole thing is flat. It's actually flat.
As a photographer, he has to think all the time about how to translate three-dimensional reality into two-dimensional surfaces. And so he sees this room as a point of inspiration, point of departure. You know, that appeals to him, but he also says that all of his photography friends love it as well. And you could miss it so easily going to the Met. There's so many other things to look at the Met. You know, this is a great example of why I made this book. Stephen Shore is taking us to the small room that you might have missed otherwise.
Ai Weiwei picked a 3,000 or 4,000-year-old jade carving. What does it say to him? Why is it important to him?
This was one of the real revelations of the book for me. Very few people know Ai Weiwei, you know, the most famous Chinese artist working today, has this important collection of jade. He's one of the few artists in the book who really has a connoisseur level knowledge of what he was discussing. And he talks about his own experience with jade during the Cultural Revolution when jade was forbidden because it was associated with the dynasties, with royalty, with everything they were trying to sweep away.
So this collection he has is a political act.
Maybe not so much anymore. It almost seems like a personal pleasure, but it does have political roots.
Judy Chicago picked a painting by Agnes Pelton that looks like a cell from Fantasia. It's kind of a dreamscape with clouds and stars and mountains.
I love the fact that Judy Chicago picked Agnes Pelton because here we have a really powerful woman artist working today. People know her name, and she is championing an artist who's not so well known. Agnes Pelton was a contemporary of Georgia O'Keeffe, and she was an early abstract painter in the 20th century. Judy Chicago sees in her abstraction the reasons why women painters in particular embraced abstraction, a kind of drive to express an interior life, interiority, an emotional, psychological drive that she doesn't see in male counterparts of the time.
Specifically, Judy Chicago says that female artists were not allowed to convey their experiences directly until the advent of abstraction.
So yeah, she is talking about abstraction.
So they can kind of slide their ideas in.
A backdoor way.
Like code.
I think so.
Next is Marina Abramović, who picked a very funky metal or metallic sculpture that looks like somebody in a crosswalk wearing very, very kind of wavy, flowing clothes.
It's someone in motion, and it's a futurist sculpture by Umberto Boccioni. And it was a really surprising choice for me because, as Marina herself said, futurism is horribly out of fashion these days. It's associated with Mussolini and fascism historically. So it's like the least popular thing in the art world. What she talks about is how artwork can embody or materialize the very immaterial thing that we call energy. And this is something that Marina Abramović also does or tries to do through her performances. So you can see this really interesting connection to her own work.
I'm talking with art writer Jory Finkel about her book, It Speaks to Me. I think John Baldessari could have worked a little harder on his entry, but I do like that he says René Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe is not a very good painting.
Right, right. He says it's an illustration of a painting or an illustration of an idea instead.
And I don't think he's saying it's a bad work of art. He's just saying it's not a very good painting.
Right, right. That the work of art itself, the power of this work is in the combination of text and images, which of course has also defined John Baldessari's career.
What I like about it is that it gives, I think, regular viewers, non-expert viewers, kind of the right or the inspiration to say, well, that's not very good, you know, which is important. Or I don't like it. You don't have to like something just because it's famous.
Yeah, he is one of our great conceptual artists, and he is knocking art off its pedestal.
Mark Bradford did not have a poster of Kiss on his wall or Farrah Fawcett or Sean Cassidy when he was a kid. Instead, it was one of Mark Rothko's color block paintings.
Mark is one of a number of artists in the book who chose something in their childhood, the poster version hanging on his wall that somehow gave him permission to be an artist or permission to think about surfaces in a serious way.
But then as he got older, he realized that Rothko was part of like basically the white male art establishment and didn't like the piece anymore or didn't take it as inspiration anymore.
Yeah, no, I like that, you know, he talks about how by the time he got to CalArts and he was an older student at CalArts, he discovered that Rothko and his whole milieu was very white, very male, wouldn't have room for a black gay artist like Mark Bradford.
Why'd you write this book?
It really frustrates me that so much of the art world is inaccessible, that galleries are built sometimes designed to be off-putting, to say, don't come in. And I really thought that a book like this could open the doors in a way to contemporary art for a lot more people.
You also write in a way that is actually accessible, unlike a lot of label copy at museums.
I try.
Jory Finkel covers art for the New York Times and the Art Newspaper, and her new book is It Speaks to Me. Thursday evening, she'll be with two of the artists included in the book for a program at the Hammer Museum.
It's Rikrit Tiruvaneej, the Thai artist, and Shanique Smith, an American artist. I thought their interviews in the book were weirdly similar, so I thought, wouldn't it be fun to continue the conversation in a live format at the Hammer?
We've got details at theframe.org. Thanks, Joy.
Thank you, John.
Before we wrap the show today, if you love movies, listen to The Frame's Summer Movie Special with stories about the summer's most interesting films, interviews with Kumail Nanjiani, Emma Thompson, and Olivia Wilde, and the skinny on how Quentin Tarantino recreated 1969 Hollywood. The Frame's Summer Movie Special at 2 and 7 on Memorial Day. I'm John Raby, in for John Horn. Have a great weekend.